Lecture 24, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persum, November 6th, 2006.
Okay, let's get started. Homework 4 is due today, so make sure I get it before I leave today. Homework 5 will be handed out next day or two, so stay tuned. It's not due till a week from Friday, so you'll have plenty of time to work on it. What we did last time is introduce qualitatively the theory of an infinitely periodic potential. And from that, we made an argument based upon Bragg reflection that we should see an opening of a band gap at the Brillouin zone boundaries. Furthermore, we saw that the slope of the EK diagram at the band edges would go to zero. Both of these results will imply many things about the properties of materials. But the argument I made was quite qualitative and therefore maybe unsatisfactory to many of you. And so what we'll do today is solve the problem exactly. It'll be a simple one-dimensional model for a solid known as the Kronig-Penney model. And we'll do that exactly in class today. And we'll see that the result of the exact solution matches that of the qualitative argument we made last time. Before we do that, though, I have to introduce a concept which are known as block waves. If you recall yesterday, I read a quote from Bloch. Bloch was a central figure in the development of solid-state physics. And Bloch proposed that in weak periodic potentials, like what we'd expect to find in a solid, the Schrödinger equation gives solutions of the following form. The wave function will be equal to some function u times e to the I k dot r, or these will be known as block waves. They look very similar to plane waves, but with some prefactor, some amplitude term u. And what's important about u is that u will be periodic, where a is the lattice vector. Okay, so I read you this quote last time, and Bloch describes that he was happy to find that the solution of an electron in a periodic potential is very similar to that of a free electron, except with a periodic modulation, and that periodic modulation would be the function u. So Bloch proposed this. What does this imply? This implies that if we were to then determine what the wave function was at a position A, one lattice constant away, we just plug into this equation. We see that it's equal to u of r plus a times e to the ik dot product r plus a. But the Bloch condition tells us that this term here is just equal to u. So this will be equal to u of r times e to the I k dot r times e to the I k dot a, since the sum and the exponent will become a product of the two exponents. But u of r times e to the I k dot r is just equal to psi. And so this is just equal to psi times e to the I k dot a. Of course, the left-hand side is still psi of r plus a. And so Bloch's proposal implies this new boundary condition for a wave function in the presence of a weakly periodic potential. What it will allow us to do is reduce this problem. And if you were to think about this problem, let's say we had an infinitely periodic potential. If we were to try to solve that problem the way that I taught you in the first half of the course, what you'd do is you'd write down what the general form of the solution was at every region in space, and there'd be an infinite number of regions in space. Then you'd have to employ boundary conditions, that is continuity of psi and continuity of d psi dx, at each of those infinite boundary conditions. So you'd have an infinite dimensional problem to solve. And that would be quite daunting. The block condition will allow us to reduce this down to one period, because once we know what the wave function is in one period, we can determine it in every other point in space by recursively applying the block condition. So we're going to reduce this infinite problem down to one period of that periodic potential and use this boundary condition as a way of connecting the two sides of that period together. An extremely powerful result. So to write that down, what that tells us is that we only need to solve the Schrodinger equation within one period of the periodic potential. Since recursive application of the block condition generates the solution everywhere else. Okay, extremely powerful in solving these problems in solid state physics. Now, the three-dimensional proof of this is relatively tedious. It requires vector mathematics. So what I'll do is give you the one-dimensional proof, and you could easily see how it generalizes to the 3D case. So since it's so fundamental, let me give you that one-dimensional proof. I'm following Cattell, but if you read Cattell, the problem with Cattell is he leaves out all the details. So I'm going to inject the details into class. So hopefully you can see how Cattell gets the things that he derives. That'll be true with the Kronig-Penney model as well. I'll follow Cattell's notation, but inject the details, which are omitted. Okay, so this is a one-dimensional proof of Bloch's theorem. To do this, we first have to define a new operator. So we're going back to the first part of the course. Remember, this is a solution to the Schrodinger equation. And so what I'm going to do is define the displacement operator D. And if D were to operate on some test function F, what it will do is displace F by A. So D operating on F displaces it one unit A in space. And as a result, for a periodic potential, which is what we're talking about today, by periodic potential, I mean that V of X will be equal to V of X plus NA, where N is any integer. Right, the potential is periodic. So if we were to go one lattice constant, two lattice constants, n lattice constants in either direction, we'll get the same value. So for a periodic potential, then what I want to calculate is the commutation relationship between the displacement operator and the Hamiltonian operator. And to do that, we're going to have it operate on a test function to make sure that we do things correctly. So I'm going to have D, H operate on F. This, of course, will be dH operating on F minus HD operating on F. So we'll go ahead and do that. I'm going to write out the Hamiltonian. So D will first operate on H. The Hamiltonian, as you hopefully recall, is negative H bar squared over 2m. Second derivative with respect to X. And of course, this is operating on F plus the potential operating on F. So that's dHf. That'll be minus hdF. Okay. So we want to have d operate now on each term in this equation. So d is a displacement operator. So if d were to operate on the first term, what we'd get out is minus h bar squared over 2m. Second derivative of f of x plus a with respect to x. D will operate now on this new function v times f, so they're both going to be displaced. So v of x plus a, f of x plus a, minus h. Now I'm going to have d operate on f, which will just make it f of x plus a. We then recognize that because the potential is periodic, v of x plus a is just v of x. And so this is equal to negative h bar squared over 2m, second derivative of x plus a with respect to x, plus v of x times f of x plus a, minus h f of x plus a. But negative h bar squared second derivative with respect to x plus v operating on f of x plus a is just a Hamiltonian operator operating on f of x plus a. So these two terms just become h times f of x plus a minus h f of x plus a, which is of course equal to 0. And so what this analysis shows is that the displacement operator and the Hamiltonian commute. Okay. Everybody comfortable with this? This is sort of a flashback to a few weeks ago. Now, because d and h commute, we can find simultaneous eigenfunctions for both d and h, just as we did when we were looking at angular momentum. So this implies that simultaneous eigenfunctions exist for h and d. And of course, what that means, and what we already know, is that the eigenfunctions for the Hamiltonian are just a stationary state wave function psi, and they'll give you back out the eigenvalue, which is the energy times psi. So that's just the Schrodinger equation. But it tells you that the exact same eigenfunctions, that is the stationary state functions of the Schrodinger equation, are also eigenfunctions for d. So simultaneously, if d were to operate on psi, we get out some constant lambda times psi. Where lambda is some complex constant. Okay. Now, let's think about this. D times psi is just psi of x plus a, which we now know is equal to lambda times psi of x. Okay, so it looks like we're getting pretty close to this statement here, because any complex number, lambda, which is non-zero, can be expressed as e to the I times some real number times a, some constant. Okay, so this immediately implies the block result. What I want to do is take it one step farther so we see that that is in fact the case. What is not clear yet is if k for a periodic potential in the exponent is actually real. If it is real, then this will be a true statement, that this implies the block result. Okay, everybody okay with this so far? All right. So the trick here, and this is the catch, if we really had an infinitely periodic potential, the block result would immediately result. But of course, no solid is infinitely periodic. All right, there'll be some finite number of atoms. There'll be a large number of atoms, but it will be finite. And so this is the trick. So we recognize that while no solid is infinitely periodic, n is large, on the order of Avogadro's number, which would be 10 to the 23rd, which suggests the following model to salvage Locke's theorem. Okay. So the question is, how do we include something, a system which is effectively infinitely periodic from the perspective of an electron? And the electron is at some region in space defined by its wave packet, which will be on the order of the lattice constant. And it's going to see 10 to the 23rd atoms. So it's going to look like it's infinitely periodic, but there is a finite number, n. And so the question is, how do we include both of these effects in the model? And so the trick, which is employed in solid-state physics, is to model the solid as n lattice points. Okay. So that takes into account that there's a finite number of atoms. As n lattice points on a ring, with circumference capital N times A. What this allows us to do is say that if we were to go around the ring, we would get an infinite number of points. So it's periodic, if you will. But there's a finite number of lattice points making up that infinitely periodic system. What it tells you is that if you look at the wave function at some point and then go to that point plus N times A, you get back to where you started. And so it implies an additional boundary condition on the problem. So this implies that psi of x plus nA will be equal to psi of x. But we just showed that for each step that you take, each position A, you get a factor of lambda. That's what we just proved, that psi of x plus a is equal to lambda times psi of x. And so if you were to go n steps, you take lambda to the nth power times psi. This is equal to lambda to the nth times psi. And as a result, now it allows us to calculate what lambda is. Okay, we want to show that lambda is of the form of e to the ik. So if we look at this equation, it tells you that lambda to the nth power is just equal to 1. And so you may conclude, well, then lambda is equal to 1. That's one solution. But of course, 1 can be written in complex notation as e to the I 2 pi times n, where n is an integer, right? If you employ Euler's formula, you get cosine 2 pi n plus I sine 2 pi n. Sine 2 pi n is 0. Cosine 2 pi n is 1. And as a result, this is the complex representation of the number 1. And it tells you that there's an infinite number of ways to express this. What we can now do is solve for lambda, and this implies that lambda will be equal to e to the I 2 pi lowercase n divided by capital N. And as a result, if we go back to our previous equation, psi of x plus a will be equal to e to the I 2 pi n over capital N times psi, which we could easily write in the following form, e to the ika times psi, where now we can see that k is equal to 2 pi n divided by capital N times a. N is an integer, 2 pi is, of course, a real number, a is a real number, and capital N is a real number. And as a result, we see that k is real. And as a result, we've now deduced the Bloch theorem in one dimension. Okay. We've come up with the same boundary condition that Bloch proposed. One other note. Importantly, since we've shown that k is real, if we were to take the magnitude squared of psi of x plus a, then we have to take the magnitude squared of the right-hand side of this equation. But since k and a are real, then this is just a complex number whose amplitude is 1. And as a result, this is just simply equal to the amplitude squared of psi. And this is what we would expect. If we have a perfectly periodic potential, then the position of the electron, which is represented by the magnitude squared of psi, should also be periodic. Okay. Question?
In the case of a nanoscale object where n wasn't large, what would you try and change?
Yeah, then life becomes much more complicated. What we're going to do tomorrow is look at that specific case. What we've done today, and the assumption we'll make in Kronig-Penney model, is that it's really infinitely periodic. And so the question is, how large does n have to be for an infinitely periodic approximation to be accurate? Is that 1 million atoms? Is it 10 to the 23rd atoms? Is it 20 atoms? And if you go on the nanometer scale, you're going to get into that limit of what is capital N for it to be infinitely periodic. And what we'll do is develop a strategy next time where we'll be able to do this from 2 atoms and up. So we'll build up 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 20, 50, and then we'll go look at the limiting case of an infinite number of atoms. We'll collapse back down to the Kronig-Penney result. And in the homework, you'll get to actually calculate, and this will require numerical techniques, the result for those finite number of atom systems. You'll see that band structure, as we're going to see developing here, will manifest itself after only about 10 to 20 atoms. You'll already begin to see band structure evolving. And so even in the nanometer scale system, you're going to see evidence of band structure, but there will be some quantization inside of that band structure resulting from the finite size of the system. Yeah, there's a beautiful paper which Griffiths actually wrote, which we'll follow in analyzing this problem. And it's an extremely powerful approach, because you can use it for any system where you have more than one. So, for example, this potential here, right, this is a double tunnel barrier problem, is a real mess if you solve it the way I taught you to solve it thus far. So you have to apply boundary conditions at 1, 2, 3, 4 positions. So you'd have 8 equations, 8 unknowns, right? Whereas the approach that I'll show you over the next couple days will make this problem trivial. That's a very powerful approach that we'll develop. And we'll also then look at a case where we have 10 or 20 of these periodic, or these periods in a periodic potential. Okay. So, that's where we're going. Before we do that, though, I want to take you through the textbook example, which is from Cattell. And this is a famous model called the Kronig-Penney model. The Kronig-Penney model is going to allow us to calculate exactly the band structure for this idealized system. And of course, we're just going to do a basic one-dimensional treatment, which could be generalized to 3D. The math is messier, but the results are the same. So we'll just do the 1D treatment in class. So what is the Kronig-Penney model? Kronig-Penney assumed that we can model a solid in the following way. So it's what I just wrote down, this double barrier tunnel problem, but now we're going to do it an infinite number of times. I'm going to use the notation of Cattell, which is different than Griffiths, so keep track of it. Cattell calls the potential U as opposed to V. U is the crystal potential. It's an infinitely periodic potential where the height of these barriers is some constant U naught. The width of the barriers will be B, some distance B. And so if this is x in this direction, and this is 0, this would represent the position in space of x equal to minus b. The spacing between the barriers is a, and as a result, this position here would be a plus b. So the periodicity of the system would be a plus b. Going from this position here to that position there is one period. What we're going to later do is reduce these rectangular barriers to delta functions. And as we do that, we're going to let the area under the barrier be constant. This area for rectangles is trivial. It's just u naught times b. We'll say that is going to be a constant even if we reduce this to a delta function. So the prefactor in front of the delta function will be u naught times b. The last thing that we will assume is that the energy is somewhere between 0 and u naught. So the energy is, say, there. This, of course, will be true in all cases once we let u naught go to infinity, as we will for a delta function. And this will be true for all values. So we'll analyze it first in this case, and then we'll take it to the limiting case of delta functions. That's the Kornig-Penney model. So, again, without knowing Bloch's theorem, this would be a very daunting problem. Because while we could write down what the general solution would be at every point in space, there would be an infinite number of points in space, or regions in space. And as a result, we'd have to apply the boundary conditions at all of these infinite number of discontinuities in the potential. And so even for the double barrier problem, it's sort of unruly to handle it the way that we've learned thus far, let alone an infinitely periodic system. And so what's going to bail us out is the Bloch periodicity condition question.
Is this the same potential as we were dealing with before that was, you know, from the ions in a crystal?
Yeah, that potential before we assumed looked like this, right? And the energy would be somewhere here. So it's similar, right? We're approximating this now as rectangular. That's also true, but the energy would have also been negative before. Now we're assuming, in this case, that the energy is going to be positive and the barriers are going to be positive. Yeah. So this problem can be solved. So Kornig-Penney is reducing to this problem here. Right? And how we would like to do it is what you're suggesting, is like this. That would be more accurate. The two solutions here are quite similar, actually. Griffiths goes through them. You may want to read about them. There are very subtle differences between these two solutions. The general behavior that we're going to find will be the same in both cases. But there are some subtle differences, because here, obviously, negative energies will be permitted, whereas in this case, there's no such thing as a negative energy. The point, though, of these periodic potentials, and that's what we'll show over the next couple days, is that no matter how you slice a periodic potential, the details are not relevant. So the difference between those two cases, pointing up and pointing down, are very subtle. The qualitative behavior will be exactly the same. And that's what saves us. If the solution to the periodic potential varied significantly as a function of the details of the potential, then it would be very difficult to generalize anything about solids. Each and every solid would have to be a completely new solution. The general behavior will be the same. That allows us to generalize the behavior of metals versus semiconductors versus insulators. But there will be solid differences. The band gap of silicon is different than the band gap of gallium arsenide. And that's due to the fact that there are subtle differences in the details of the potential. So the details of the potential will give us subtle differences to give us the richness of material science. But the qualitative behavior will be the same, independent of the details of the periodic potential. Okay. Any other questions before we jump into this? Okay. So this is our problem. It's clearly stated. Now we want to solve it. What we'll do is we will break it up into regions in space. The first region will be in the potential wells. For example, we see there's a potential well for for x between 0 and a. And in that region, of course, the potential is zero. Fortunately, we know how to solve this problem. We solved it many times in this course. And the general solution, when we have zero potential, are going to be traveling waves. A, e to the I. Now I'm going to call kappa x to follow Cattell's notation, plus b e to the negative I kappa x, where e is, of course, h bar squared kappa squared over 2m. So this is a solution we solved many times for the free particle, for particle in a box, etc. In the potential barriers, which are the only other unique region in space, for example, we have a potential barrier for x between negative b and 0. The potential in that region in space is just this constant u naught. And as a result, the general solution, we know inside of a barrier, exponentially decaying and exponentially growing solutions as opposed to traveling waves. And we'll have the form of c e to the qx, again following Cattell's notation, plus d e to the negative qx, where u naught minus e is equal to h bar squared q squared over 2m. Okay. Now, to reduce this, again, from an infinite dimensional problem down to one period, we're going to exploit the block periodicity condition. So we just derived this in 1D. In this particular problem, the most convenient way to write down the block periodicity condition is to say that the wave function for values of x between a and a plus b will be equal to the wave function for regions between negative b and 0 times e to the ik times the length of the period, which is a plus b. Okay. So for example, if we wanted to compare psi at a with psi at minus b, we have to multiply the value of the wave function at minus b times e to the negative, or e to the ik a plus b. So what we're going to do is just consider one region in space between negative b and a. We'll, of course, employ boundary conditions at x equals 0, which will be easy. That's how we've always done it. But we'll connect the solution at a with the solution at minus b using the block periodicity condition. And that will allow us to generalize to all regions in space. So now this problem is no more difficult than the tunnel barrier problem, which you all have already solved in the homework. The only difference is we have this additional term e to the ik a plus b, and that'll make the math slightly more messy. Okay. So of course, the objective then, or the strategy, will be to combine the block periodicity condition with the continuity requirements for psi and d psi dx. These continuity conditions are simple in this case because the potential is finite. So we have finite discontinuity, so psi and d psi dx are continuous. We'll then take the limit as the solution goes to a delta function, and in that limit we'll see what will happen. The other way to go about doing this is how Griffiths does it, if you want to see a different way of solving the same problem. How Griffiths does it is he immediately goes to the delta functions. And when you go to the delta functions, then of course, d psi dx is not continuous. There's that discontinuity relationship that we derived last time. So you can utilize that. That allows you to skip the limits we're going to take later. The limiting way that I'm doing it, though, is the traditional Kronig-Penney model, so I'll do it that way in class. That's how Cattell does it as well. But as I said, Cattell skips all the details, so I'll try to fill in the important details for you. Okay. So it's just math. We know how to do this. We'll first go to x equals 0 and say psi must be continuous. Okay. At x equals 0, psi is a plus b here and c plus d there. And as a result, we see that a plus b equals c plus d. That's one equation. D psi dx has to be continuous. So we'll take the derivatives and plug in x equals 0. The first equation will give us I kappa A minus B. That'll be equal to Q C minus D. Those are the values of the derivatives at x equals 0. So that should look exactly the same as you did for the tunnel barrier problem. We'll then do this again at x equals A and connect it back to the solution at x equals minus B using the block periodicity condition. We'll do that for psi and d psi dx. And what that will give us is four equations and four unknowns, which in principle could be solved for A, B, C, and D. And that would give us the wave function in the first region in space, and then we could extend it to any other region in space using the block periodicity condition. But as I've alluded to now several times in this course, in solid-state physics, we often don't care what the wave functions are, just that they exist and are non-zero. And as once we have a 4x4 series of equations, we'll just set the determinant of those coefficients to zero, and that will verify that there is a solution. And that will give us a unique relationship between the energy and K, and allow us to derive the EK relationship. So let's do this. We did x equals 0. At x equals A, what we're going to do is compare psi evaluated at A with psi evaluated at minus B using the block periodicity condition. So we know that psi has to be continuous. So that tells us that A e to the I kappa A plus B e to the negative I kappa A will be equal to C e to the negative QB, where we've now evaluated the second general form at x equals minus B, plus D e to the QB times IK A plus B, the block periodicity condition. So we've connected those two regions in space. In addition, d psi dx has to be continuous. So we'll go ahead and take the derivatives. On the left-hand side, we'll get I kappa A e to the I kappa A minus B e to the negative I kappa A. On the right-hand side, we'll again take the derivative. We'll get Q times C e to the negative QB minus D e to the QB times the block connector, which is e to the I k A plus B. So this is our third equation, and that's our fourth equation. Like I said, from these, we could determine what A, B, C, and D are, and therefore know what the wave functions are at every point in space. But we really don't care what the wave functions are, just that they exist. If they exist, then we should be able to develop a unique relationship between E, the energy, and K, the wave vector. So that's what we want to do. These four equations will only have a solution if the determinant of the coefficients of A, B, C, and D is equal to 0. Okay. And this is where it gets quite messy, and we won't bother evaluating the determinant in class. But you can see that we're going to have a 4x4 determinant, which is already a pain in the neck. And furthermore, we have all these terms here, these e to the I kappa terms, these e to the I k terms, and these e to the negative QB terms. You have to go through and execute this. And in the undergraduate version of this course, I have the students do this for extra credit if they're so inclined. It takes me about 3 pages of algebra to do it. And it's sort of a rite of passage. If you want to be a card-carrying solid-state physicist, you can do it in your spare time. I'll just give you the result, though. The result of that 4x4 determinant is the following equation. q squared minus kappa squared divided by 2 q kappa times the hyperbolic sine of qb times the sine of kappa a plus the hyperbolic cosine of qb times the cosine of kappa a will be equal to cosine k a plus b. Now, if we just eyeball, yeah, question.
I'm sorry, I think it might just be a wording thing, but it's confusing me. You said the coefficients of a, b, c, and d, but those are the coefficients that we're taking the determinants of, right?
What I'm saying is we're trying to solve for a, b, c, and d. Uh-huh. So the coefficient in front of a would be e to the I kappa a. That's what goes into the determinant. So if we just eyeball the solution, this should make some sense to us. We have some terms that go as hyperbolic sine and cosine of qb. Remember, hyperbolic sine and cosine are sums and differences of terms of e to the qb and e to the minus qb. So that makes sense. We have sine kappa and cosine kappa terms. Again, sine and cosine terms can be expressed in terms of e to the I kappa and e to the minus I kappa. So they show up. And finally, we have term of the form cosine k a plus b. And again, that can be expressed in terms of e to the I k a plus b, which also exists in our solution. So it looks like this is what it should turn out. It's something like this. Getting this coefficient here, of course, is the key element of the actual solution, which, again, you can do if you're so inclined or don't trust me. And Cattell, in his book, he writes this, that it is rather tedious to obtain this equation, which I think is a fair statement. This equation, unfortunately, while it tells us the EK relationship, it's not obvious that it does. And so what we do in the Koenig-Penney analysis is to simplify the analysis of this resulting equation is we let the barriers reduce to delta functions. What does that mean? I.e., we let the width of the barrier go to zero and the height of the barrier go to infinity such that q squared times b times a over 2, which would be because of some term p, is finite. So this should be clear that it is finite. Remember, q squared is proportional to u naught, and u naught times b is the area under the delta function, which is a constant and finite. So q squared times b is finite, a is of course finite, and 2 is of course finite, so p is finite. And it's written this way to make the math simpler in a minute. So what we have to do is take this top equation and employ the limit as u naught goes to infinity and b goes to 0 such that this term p is finite. And so what we're going to do is consider each term in that equation and take the limit. And Cattell just gives you the answer, but there's one trick here, which if you haven't seen before, you really should see, so that's why I'll do it in class. Okay, so let's do this. This is an exercise in taking limits. So the first limit I want to do is take the limit as u naught goes to infinity and b goes to 0 of q. Okay. That'll, of course, be the limit as u naught goes to infinity and b goes to 0 of square root of 2m u naught minus e over h bar. Everything here, m, 2, e, h bar are all finite. U naught's going to infinity, and so this is unambiguous. The limit is infinity. Okay. However, since p, which is q squared ab over 2, is finite, the limit as u naught goes to infinity and b goes to 0 of q times b is ambiguous because q is going to infinity and b is going to 0. But remember, p is finite. So if we express this in terms of p, then this will be equivalent to the limit as u naught goes to infinity and b goes to 0 of 2 times p over qa. 2, p, and a are finite, q is going to infinity, as we just showed, and as a result, q times b goes to 0. Okay. That allows us to now evaluate one of the terms in our equation. So we want to take the limit as u naught goes to infinity and b goes to 0 of hyperbolic cosine qb cosine kappa a. We know in this limit qb goes to 0, and as a result, this is just equal to the hyperbolic cosine of 0 times cosine kappa a. Hyperbolic cosine of 0 is just 1, and as a result, the second term in our equation just becomes cosine kappa a. Let's go to another term in our equation. Limit as u goes to infinity, b goes to 0, of negative kappa squared over 2 q kappa hyperbolic sine qb times sine kappa a. This is simply equal to negative kappa over 2 q times hyperbolic sine of 0, because qb is going to 0, times sine of kappa a. Kappa is, of course, finite. Q is going to infinity. Hyperbolic sine of 0 is 0, so 0 divided by infinity is definitely 0. And so this limit is just equal to 0. We have two more terms to go. How about the right-hand side of the equation? Let's take the limit as u naught goes to infinity and b goes to 0 of cosine k a plus b. This is simple. The only term here which is relevant is b going to 0. And as a result, this is equal to cosine kA. And finally, the last term, which is the first term in the equation, is the one which I've been building up to. This is the tricky one. Limit u naught goes to infinity and b goes to 0 of q squared over 2q kappa hyperbolic sine qb times sine of kappa a. What I want to do is express this term here in terms of p. So I'll do that. We recognize that q squared over 2 is equal to p over ab. So this is equal to the limit as u naught goes to infinity and b goes to 0 of p over q kappa ab times hyperbolic sine of qb times sine of kappa a. If we look at this, we know that qb is going to 0. P, kappa, and a are finite. Hyperbolic sine of qb is going to 0. And so this will be equal to hyperbolic, or be proportional to hyperbolic sine of 0 over 0, which is 0 over 0, which is an indeterminate form. And as a result, when you face an indeterminate limit, how you resolve this problem is by applying L'Hopital's rule from calculus. Recall L'Hopital's rule. It tells you that you differentiate the numerator and the denominator of your indeterminate limit by the term which is forcing it to be indeterminate. And in particular, the term which is forcing us to be indeterminate is q times b. So we want to differentiate the numerator and denominator with respect to the product of q times b. And as a result, we can express this now as a new limit of p over kappa a, because the derivative of this denominator with respect to qb is just kappa a. The numerator will be, instead of hyperbolic sine, the derivative is hyperbolic cosine of qb times sine of kappa a. Now we can plug this in. We know that q times b is going to 0. Hyperbolic cosine of 0 is 1. And as a result, this is just equal to p over kappa a times sine of kappa a. And as a result, if we take all of this analysis down and plug it into our original equation, we see that that original equation reduces to P over kappa A sine kappa A plus cosine kappa A is equal to cosine kA. Okay. So what? Well, we know that the right-hand side of this equation can never exceed 1. The cosine function is bounded between 1 and minus 1. Whereas the left-hand side of this equation can definitely exceed 1 and minus 1. And as a result, there will only be certain values of kappa which satisfy this equation. That is, there are going to be bands of kappa which are allowed and band gaps of kappa which are not allowed. Kappa, if you recall, is directly related to energy. Energy is h bar squared kappa squared over 2m. And as a result, if kappa has bands, then energy will also have bands. So the result of the Kronig-Penney analysis is that we now have a quantitative relationship which tells us exactly what values of energies are allowed and exactly what values of energy are not allowed. And we're going to see that the exact values will be a function of k. And as a result, there are going to be points in space, points in k space, where the band gaps will open, points in k space, where there will be allowed bands. And we're going to find, and we'll look at the plot next time, of this equation, that at pi over a, 2 pi over a, 3 pi over a, 4 pi over a, etc., is where the band gaps will open, exactly as we found in our qualitative analysis using the Bragg reflection argument. And we'll also see in the EK relationship that the slope of the EK relationship will go to 0 at the band edges, again, consistent with what we saw before. So we'll look at a plot of this equation next time, plugging in real numbers, and we'll see if we'll be able to calculate all these parameters exactly for the Kronig-Penney model. All right, we'll continue there next time.
MSE 405.